Picture this, if you will. You're an emergency physician taking sign out from a colleague in the emergency department. Your colleague briefly tells you about the patient, a 56-year-old male that's being admitted for pancreatitis with a lipase of 2,500. When you ask why he has pancreatitis, your colleague says in a somewhat distracted way, I saw something about alcohol abuse in the chart. He tells you the patient will likely be boarding in the ER because of limited bed availability, then hurries off to his daughter's dance recital. 2 hours later, the charge nurse informs you that the patient has had a change in clinical course. He spiked a fever of 39 Celsius and is persistently tachycardic to a heart rate of 120 beats per minute. You ask the charge nurse to page the hospitalist, but since a patient may be actively decompensating in your department, you decide to take a look yourself. So you grab the patient's chart and walk in the room to check on him. And you see an ill-appearing, jaundiced male with Frank Rigers looking back at you from the gurney. And welcome to Audio Bricks. I'm Arjun Iyer, bringing topics from gastroenterology from our bricks to your ears. After completing this section, you'll be able to 1. Explain the difference between cholelithiasis, cholangitis, cholecystitis, and cholecystitis, and list the most common causes of each. 2. Describe the pathogenesis of both cholesterol and pigment gallstones. 3. List the major risk factors for the development of gallstones, describe the typical clinical course, and list the potential complications. 4. Distinguish acute from chronic cholecystitis in terms of the clinical presentation, signs, and lab abnormalities. And 5. Describe the treatment of both cholelithiasis and acute cholecystitis. Part 1. How do gallstones form? Gallstones are the hardened precipitates of the substrates found in bile, the biologic surfactant made by the liver to digest fats. Bile is stored and concentrated in the gallbladder, and when you increase the concentration of a solution, you increase the likelihood of a solute precipitating out. That's some chemistry knowledge I just dropped on y'all. So in order for gallstones to form, one of the following are required. First, the bile generally needs to contain excess glycoproteins like mucin that serve as nucleation points for stone formation. Second, impaired gallbladder contraction leads to less mixing of bile within the gallbladder, or gallbladder stasis. And just like sugar dissolves in water better when you stir it, failing to stir the bile with gallbladder contractions allows solute to fall out of solution. Finally, the bile needs to become supersaturated with one of its solutes. 80% of the time, that solute is cholesterol, leading to squishy, yellowish-green stones. About 20% of the time, that solute is unconjugated bilirubin, leading to the formation of hard, blackish-green pigment stones. Part 2. Who gets gallstones? As we mentioned earlier, cholesterol stones are the most common form of gallstones. In terms of epidemiology, people who form cholesterol gallstones tend to fall under the well-known gallstone archetype of fat, fertile females over 40. And it makes sense if you break it down. Obesity and hypercholesterolemia are linked by metabolic syndrome. Age is a pretty easy one to remember. But remember that gallstones become much more common after age 40, not just in your 40s. Being female and fertile is actually very important, and it all comes down to estrogen and progesterone. At the molecular level, estrogen alters cholesterol metabolism to promote excretion of cholesterol in bile, whereas progesterone not only decreases bile salt synthesis, but also relaxes gallbladder smooth muscle, like it relaxes most other smooth muscle. So the four Fs, as they're called, are pretty well known. But there's two lesser known Fs that also play a big role, family and pharmacology. You have to be real bad at spelling for that one to make sense. A family history of gallstones, or ethnicity, plays a pretty big role in which patients get gallstones. Native Americans have the highest prevalence of gallstones, and the best example is the Pima people of Arizona, who have like a 75% prevalence of gallstones in women over 25. And finally, pharmacology means that certain drugs increase the likelihood of gallstone formation. Octreotide is pretty intuitive, since it's just pharmacologic somatostatin, the hormone that makes your gallbladder and the rest of the GI tract stop moving and digesting. But the weird and more commonly used one that you should remember is ceftriaxone, a very commonly used antibiotic in the inpatient setting. In contrast, pigment stones are most commonly seen in the setting of chronic hemolysis, i.e. when red blood cells are being broken down at a faster rate than the liver can conjugate the bilirubin. The breakdown of RBCs releases bilirubin into the blood that the liver attempts to excrete in the bile. Conjugation increases the water solubility of bilirubin, But if hemolysis exceeds the capacity of the liver to conjugate it, then you start to secrete the much less soluble unconjugated bilirubin into the bile. The excess of bilirubin in pigment stones is what gives them that blackish color. All right, guys, pop quiz time. What are the six Fs that describe which populations tend to form cholesterol gallstones? The four most common ones that everyone know are fat, fertile females over 40. But don't forget that family history and pharmacology can contribute as well. Part 3. Where can gallstones end up? So whether it's a squishy cholesterol stone or a hard little pigment stone, once a gallstone forms, it can pose a variety of problems. During digestion of a fatty meal, the gallbladder contracts to eject bile into the lumen of the duodenum. And if the gallstones are small enough, they just get ejected along with it. Where you run into problems is when a gallstone gets stuck. Now, just to review the anatomy of the biliary tree, where is bile produced? The liver, that's right. The hepatic bile gets secreted into the bile canaliculi that merge into ductules that all merge together at the common hepatic duct. If you follow the biliary tree further towards the duodenum, you'll come to a Y-shaped junction with two other major bile ducts. And what are those two other ducts that the hepatic duct intersects? The cystic duct, which comes off the gallbladder, merges with the common hepatic duct to form the common bile duct. That eventually leads to the duodenum, and the release of bile is controlled by the sphincter of Oddi, or the gatekeeper to the duodenum. But the common bile duct merges with one other duct before reaching the duodenum. Can you remember what it is? It's actually not a bile duct at all, but the pancreatic duct. The two merge right before the sphincter of Oddi to form a short segment known as the ampulla of Vater. If you consider our patient from the intro, you might see why this is clinically important. A gallstone can get stuck anywhere along the path from the gallbladder to the duodenum, the neck of the gallbladder, the cystic duct, the common bile duct, or the ampulla of Vater. And each of these produces a very different type of pathology, but with very similar sounding names. Fortunately, these names are pretty formulaic and make a lot of sense as long as you know the root words. The condition of having gallstones in the gallbladder is known as cholelithiasis, chole for bile and lith for stone. And it's an iasis, meaning a condition or a disease, not an itis, meaning inflammation, which is important because most of the time, gallstones are completely asymptomatic and don't cause any problems. An intermittently obstructing gallbladder with a stone that keeps blocking the neck of the gallbladder when it squeezes, then falling back into the gallbladder when it relaxes, is called biliary colic. No fancy Greek roots here. When a gallstone gets stuck in the cystic duct, it can lead to cholecystitis. Cholecyst, meaning bile sac, or the gallbladder, and itis, meaning inflammation. Not all stuck gallstones lead to cholecystitis, especially if they pass through before the inflammation starts. And occasionally, you can get cholecystitis without a stuck gallstone, but in general, the sequence of events is stone gets stuck in the cystic duct long enough, it leads to cholecystitis. Now, if the stone passes through the cystic duct and gets stuck in the common bile duct, it's called choledocholithiasis. Choledocho for bile duct, lith meaning stone. And even though this is an iasis, not an itis, this can be extremely problematic. With all of the bile outflow blocked, the pressure in the entire biliary tree increases, causing the bile canaliculi in the liver to rupture and spew toxic bile into the liver parenchyma. Another life-threatening complication is that the loss of forward bile flow, or cholestasis, allows bacteria from the GI tract to ascend the biliary tree past the obstruction. And the resulting infection is called cholangitis, cholange for bile vessel, itis for inflammation. Finally, if a stone gets stuck in the ampulla of Vater, it ends up blocking both the pancreatic and biliary trees. So, in addition to all the complications of choledocholithiasis, the pancreatic obstruction leads to gallstone pancreatitis. Got all that? I know, it's a lot of terms that sound very similar, but at least the naming is formulaic enough to remember pretty easily. Let's try a quick question to see if you got all that. What is the difference between cholelithiasis and choledocholithiasis? Cholelithiasis means gallstones in the gallbladder, and choledocholithiasis means gallstones in the common bile duct. Part 4. How do gallstones present clinically? Gallstones are super common and are found in approximately 20% of people if you were to randomly ultrasound them. But only 20% of patients with gallstones even have symptoms as a result, as in 20% of the 20% of the population with gallstones, so like 4%. I don't know, math is hard. But like we alluded to earlier, there are multiple presentations of gallstone disease caused by gallstone obstruction at different sites in the biliary tree. But in all cases, ultrasound of the right upper quadrant is the diagnostic test of choice to evaluate for and localize pathology. Cholelithiasis most commonly presents as biliary colic, an acute pain attack that develops when a stone temporarily blocks the cystic duct while the gallbladder is squeezing. Since the gallbladder contracts in order to release bile, the pain of biliary colic is, often unsurprisingly, triggered by a high-fat meal. Typically, biliary colic presents with right upper quadrant pain that can radiate to the right shoulder. The pain usually lasts less than 6 hours, basically until the gallstone passes or the gallbladder stops squeezing and the gallstone falls back into the gallbladder. In biliary colic, the patient is afebrile and stable, and the lab results are normal, but an ultrasound will typically show gallstones in the gallbladder. A gallbladder looks like an oval-shaped structure closely associated with the liver on ultrasound, and the liquid bile in the center appears dark black, like all fluid under ultrasound. A gallstone in the gallbladder looks like a very dense white object resting on the dependent portion of the gallbladder, amidst all that dark black liquid bile. But the stones are often so dense that the ultrasound waves can't penetrate through to see the entire gallstone. So what you see is a white gallstone rim close to the probe, and a dark black shadow trailing deep to the probe, towards the bottom of the screen. In about 20% of patients who have biliary colic, the stone can get lodged somewhere in the biliary tree. I don't know what it is about the number 20 that gallstones like, but it sure is a weird coincidence. The most common place for a stone to get lodged is the cystic duct, and what complication does this often lead to? Acute cholecystitis, or actual inflammation of the gallbladder. With biliary colic, the gallbladder only hurts when it's squeezing down against the pressure of a stuck stone, so when the gallbladder relaxes, the pain stops. Pain that lasts for more than 6 hours should raise suspicion for acute cholecystitis. And the presentation is similar to biliary colic, with right upper quadrant pain that radiates to the shoulder. But the pain of cholecystitis typically lasts more than 6 hours, and is associated with a positive Murphy's sign. Now, a lot of people get this one wrong, so let me explain to you what that is. The Murphy's sign is where you hook your fingers under the right side of a person's ribcage, really get in there, then ask them to breathe in. What this should do is bring the gallbladder in contact with your fingers, which, in acute cholecystitis, is so excruciatingly painful that the patient cannot complete inspiration. Since it's an itis, or inflammation, patients with cholecystitis are often febrile, with increased white blood cell counts. But acute cholecystitis in and of itself should not cause elevations in liver function tests. If LFT elevations are noted, it usually implies obstruction further down the biliary tree, or ascending infection. On ultrasound, the gallbladder wall surrounding the black or hypoechoic bile will be edematous and look thicker than usual, with free fluid often collecting around the gallbladder. So, the dark black fluid density won't just be seen inside the gallbladder, but also surrounding it in a thin stripe. Gallstones may also be seen on ultrasound, though the absence of gallstones does not exclude the diagnosis of cholecystitis. Alright, time for a knowledge check. Describe what it means to have a positive Murphy's sign. So step one, hook your fingers under the right side of the ribcage. Really get in there. Step two, ask the patient to take a deep breath in with your fingers under their ribcage. If they can't complete a full breath or stop inspiration because of the pain of the gallbladder coming in contact with your fingers, that is what's called a positive Murphy's sign. And out of all physical exam findings, this has the highest positive predictive value for acute cholecystitis. Remember that, because people will mess this one up all the time. They think it's the same as tenderness in the right upper quadrant. If left untreated, acute cholecystitis can lead to gallbladder necrosis in 20% of patients and gallbladder perforation in 2% or more. See, there's that 20% again. But if nothing disastrously bad happens as a result of acute cholecystitis, repeated bouts of cholecystitis can lead to chronic inflammation of the gallbladder, or chronic cholecystitis. As it turns out, there's no evidence that directly links chronic cholecystitis with increased morbidity or mortality. But the chronic inflammation can lead to calcification of the gallbladder wall, seen on imaging as a porcelain gallbladder. While CT is the diagnostic imaging of choice, if the calcification is heavy enough, you can actually see what looks like a bright white tracing of the gallbladder in the right upper quadrant of an abdominal X-ray. Now, here's where things get a little controversial. A porcelain gallbladder has historically been seen as a major risk factor for gallbladder cancer, or other cholangiocarcinoma. But recent studies have shown that perhaps the risk of gallbladder cancer is only associated with specific patterns of calcification. And that's way more than you need to know, but it helps explain some stuff that sounds like it's contradictory, but it's not. At the end of the day, just remember that, one, chronic cholecystitis can lead to porcelain gallbladder, but it's probably not the only thing that causes porcelain gallbladder. Two, chronic cholecystitis is not convincingly associated with any increased morbidity or mortality. Three, porcelain gallbladder is associated with an increased risk of cholangiocarcinoma, but a lot of new evidence suggests that it may only be specific patterns of calcification. A rare complication of chronic cholecystitis that comes up for some reason on tests is gallstone ileus. The pressure of a gallstone in the gallbladder combined with chronic inflammation can wear a hole or fistula between the gallbladder and intestines. If a large gallstone passes through the fistula and into the intestines, the place it tends to get stuck is at the ileocecal valve, because that's the narrowest point between the intestines and anus. So, as you can see, gallstone ileus is kind of a stupid name for this pathology, because it's not a type of ileus at all. It's a small bowel obstruction. But that about wraps it up for acute and chronic cholecystitis. Just remember that when it comes to the epidemiology and prognosis of various gallstone diseases, the number 20 pops up like a crazy amount. 20% of all people have gallstones, but only 20% of those people end up having symptoms, usually biliary colic. While most people with biliary colic only have a self-limiting disease when they eat fatty foods, about 20% of those end up having more serious complications of gallstone disease, most commonly acute cholecystitis. Finally, about 20% of patients with acute cholecystitis develop life-threatening complications like gallbladder necrosis or perforation, which is why you have to remove these patients' gallbladders. Now let's move on to manifestations of gallbladder disease that happen if the gallstone moves further down the biliary tree. What do you call it when a gallstone blocks the common bile duct? Choledocholithiasis, or bile duct stone disease. And why is obstruction of the CBD functionally different from obstruction of the cystic duct? Because if you block the common bile duct, you block all bile outflow. And this has two consequences. First, bile doesn't get into your GI tract, meaning it can't digest fats or give your stool that nice familiar brown color we're all used to. So you end up with what's classically described as clay-colored stools. Second, the pressure in the biliary tree builds up, so that stuff that normally gets excreted in the bile stays in the body. Bilirubin from heme breakdown gets retained, causing jaundice. And just to see if you remember your basic physiology, is this direct or indirect bilirubin? Because the hepatocytes are still able to conjugate bilirubin, these patients will have direct hyperbilirubinemia. And much like other patterns of biliary obstruction, the reflux of bile into the liver leads to a cholestatic pattern of elevations on liver function tests. Alkaline phosphatase is increased much higher than either AST or ALT. Ultrasound imaging often shows a common bile duct, which is visualized near the neck of the gallbladder in the region of the portal triad. Choledocholithiasis in and of itself causes liver damage, but it's also associated with the life-threatening complication ascending cholangitis. And this is where bacteria normally found in the GI tract, like E. coli, enterococci, anaerobes, ascend the biliary tree past the obstruction, causing infection in the stagnant bile. Now, ascending cholangitis is a particularly nasty infection. First, because gram-negative and anaerobic bacteria of the GI tract are highly virulent. And second, because when you have a biliary obstruction and infection, that infected bile backwashes straight up into the liver. And the liver, my friends, is basically just a big bloody sponge that provides a direct path for all those gross GI bugs to go straight into your bloodstream. And that will make you violently septic. You'll hear two buzzwords used to describe the clinical presentation of ascending cholangitis. Charcot's triad of jaundice, fever, and right upper quadrant pain, and Reynolds' pentad, where a dude named Reynolds basically stole Charcot's triad and added septic shock and encephalopathy to make a pentad. So basically, Reynolds pentad is Charcot's triad, but sicker. Labs are similar to those of choledochlothiasis, but the Y count is typically significantly higher with a left shift. Like with any other form of sepsis or septic shock, ascending cholangitis must be treated emergently with broad-spectrum antibiotics, IV fluids as tolerated, and vasopressor support as needed. But once you've managed the initial resuscitation and the patient's, you know, not going to die, both choledochlothiasis and cholangitis are treated with decompression of the common bile duct, which I'll describe in the next section. The final type of pathology caused by gallstone disease occurs when a gallstone travels all the way down the common bile duct into the ampulla of Vater, but gets stopped by the sphincter of Oddi. This occludes both the biliary and pancreatic trees, preventing the release of pancreatic juices and enzymes. And if you thought bile backwash was bad, the backwash of pancreatic digestive enzymes can cause autodigestion of the pancreas and the resulting complications of acute pancreatitis. Part 5. How is symptomatic gallstone disease treated? In general, the treatment of symptomatic gallstone disease is operative. Cholecystectomy is most commonly performed laparoscopically because it's less invasive and has a shorter recovery time. But occasionally, an open cholecystectomy needs to be performed through a larger diagonal incision at the right costal margin for reasons such as complicated anatomy or gallbladder perforation. The most important question is usually, how soon does the gallbladder need to come out? If the gallstones aren't causing problems, the answer is never, because why fix something that ain't broke? If the only manifestation of gallbladder disease is biliary colic, then while cholecystectomy is still indicated, it can be done on a non-urgent or elective basis. Until then, the incidence of biliary colic episodes can be reduced by a combination of a low-fat diet and bile acid supplementation. Remember that bile acids are the molecular surfactants that actually dissolve lipids like cholesterol in the aqueous medium of bile. Ursodeoxycholic acid is a pharmaceutical bile acid that increases the concentration of bile acids in the bile, which, in turn, increases the solubility of cholesterol and other hydrophobic solutes. Because of the increased risk of gallbladder necrosis or perforation, acute cholecystitis is generally an indication for urgent cholecystectomy, as in, get your butt to the hospital, we have to admit you, and take out your gallbladder within the next few days. For biliary obstruction that occurs further downstream, like choledocholithiasis, ascending cholangitis, and gallstone pancreatitis, the treatment of choice is usually endoscopic retrograde cholangiopancreatography, better known as ERCP. Now, ERCP is a pretty awesome modality where endoscopy meets fluoroscopy. Basically, you drive an endoscope into the mouth pretty much as far as it'll go, all the way to the duodenal papilla, behind which lies the sphincter of Oddi and the ampulla of Vater. From there, you cannulate the duodenal papilla and switch to a modality that's pretty similar to cardiac catheterization, where you shoot contrast dye into the biliary and pancreatic trees under fluoroscopy to light up the lumen. This way, you can identify obstructions and either remove them or stent past them. The sicker the patient is, the sooner the ERCP needs to be performed. Once a patient's stable, cholecystectomy is indicated, since these patients often have a very high risk of gallstone disease recurrence with major complications. Nowadays, it's often performed during the same hospital stay. All right, gang, final question. What is the first-line treatment for symptomatic gallstone disease? Try not to break your brains over this one. The treatment is none other than laparoscopic cholecystectomy. And that's a wrap. Let's see what y'all learned about gallstone disease here on Audio Breaks. First, can you name the three main factors that lead to the formation of gallstones, no matter what the gallstone's made of? Gallstones form in the presence of nucleation points like mucin, when gallbladder contraction is impaired, and when the bile becomes supersaturated with solutes like cholesterol, or less commonly, unconjugated bilirubin. Second, can you name all of the very similar sounding gallstone diseases based on where the obstruction occurs? There are 5 in total that you have to remember, so pause the video if you need some time to think. Cholelithiasis is simply the presence of gallstones in the gallbladder, and the majority of people with cholelithiasis are asymptomatic. Biliary colic is intermittent obstruction of the gallbladder neck or cystic duct while the gallbladder is squeezing. Cholecystitis is inflammation of the gallbladder, most commonly after a gallstone becomes lodged in the cystic duct. Choledocholithiasis is gallstone obstruction of the common bile duct. Finally, if an obstruction occurs at the ampulla of Vater and both the biliary and pancreatic systems are obstructed, then you get gallstone pancreatitis. Third, what is the definitive treatment for most gallstone disease? Definitive and curative treatment for most symptomatic gallstone disease is surgical, if possible, by laparoscopic cholecystectomy. For biliary colic, surgical removal can be deferred as an elective outpatient procedure. For all other types of symptomatic gallstone disease, operative management typically needs to be done urgently. Next, what are two major complications of acute cholecystitis that justify why urgent cholecystectomy is typically indicated? About 20% of patients with acute cholecystitis develop complications like gallbladder necrosis or perforation. Finally, what is the intervention of choice for choledocholithiasis, cholangitis, and gallstone pancreatitis? The intervention of choice is common bile duct decompression with endoscopic retrograde cholangiopancreatography, or ERCP. Now, armed with your newfound knowledge, let's get back to that patient from the intro. A 56-year-old male admitted with a presumptive diagnosis of alcoholic pancreatitis becomes febrile and tachycardic while boarding in the emergency department, and on exam appears jaundiced and ill. Given the additional findings, what other diagnosis would you entertain? And how would you go about working it up? While you speak to the patient, he has some difficulty concentrating, but expresses surprise when you ask about a history of alcohol abuse, claiming that he's only been properly drunk a few times in his life. He does, however, have a history of what he calls indigestion when he eats greasy food. And given the jaundice on physical exam, you start to suspect that the etiology of his pancreatitis may in fact be gallstone pancreatitis. Just as concerning, with his fever, jaundice, and abdominal pain, the patient fulfills the Charcot triad of ascending cholangitis and has the Reynolds pentad feature of encephalopathy. But rather than wait for the patient to become hypotensive to complete the Reynolds pentad, you begin treating the patient aggressively and presumptively with broad-spectrum antibiotics and IV fluids, and the patient remains normotensive. The hospitalist arrives at the bedside, and you debrief him on the events and management required during the last hour. He thanks you for your timely intervention, then confirms that the patient did in fact have a cholestatic pattern of elevated LFTs and a total bilirubin of 6.5. No ultrasound was ordered, and you suspect that your colleague's desire to sign out and get to his daughter's dance recital probably contributed to his premature closure on the diagnosis of alcoholic pancreatitis. Otherwise, he probably would have looked at the labs more closely. The patient has already been in the emergency department for 10 hours, and the hospitalist agrees to follow up on the ultrasound and call the gastroenterologist to ensure that he's scheduled for an ERCP first thing in the morning. And that's our show. If you think that that situation in the emergency department is a rare phenomenon, think again. Premature diagnostic closure affects all physicians, not just ER docs, and sign-out is always a high-risk activity for possible medical mistakes. Make sure to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts if you like what you heard. Remember, your feedback helps us improve. You can enjoy the full Bricks experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already. Until next time, friends, stay humble, be careful, and when in doubt, just go see the patient yourself.